to cover her plastic arms and warm her cotton belly. Eyes that closed with a click, opened in bright blue surprise. Glassy, serrated at the iris, but oh so beautiful. She squealed when tilted. Her dresses stitched from scraps or bought more often at the store with Mommy. She was held to, tossed about and whispered to, answering the mysterious summons. She was Joan or Marianne or Ginny. Two perfect teeth shone between rose-cut lips. She was perfection in plastic. Now, a living skin, almost as clear as hers, but breathing, covered with tiny pores and moving all by itself. The eyes will be deeper, midnight turning to brown or blue, too, though softer, less like a mirror. It will answer the mysterious summons that was harvested in fantasy and be held to, tossed about, still whispered to, yet be real.
Lullaby and good night, my mother's delight. Bright angels around, my darling shall stand. They will guard me from harms. Thou shalt wake in my arms. They will guard me from harms. Thou shalt wake in my arms.
A Sense of Place, a documentary series which looks at regions and regionalism in the state of Minnesota. Produced by Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. This program is called A Region Within Walls.
When he was first born, it was a very escapist attitude of mine to be able to think of years in the future, just because I was suffering so much with what was happening then, and I could tell no one about it at the time. You know, they'd ask me how I was, and I just would really lie because I didn't want to admit that it was that bad. It was too hard for me to say, you know. So at that time, everything was in the future, and what was happening to me was so foggy. It really wasn't real. I didn't consider it as real. It was just something that had to be done and gotten over with.
First of all, my babies were born early, and they had to stay in an incubator at the hospital for a month. And so I never had any physical contact with them until they were 4 weeks old. And I went down to the hospital every day to look at them, and I couldn't identify, really relate that these were my children. They belonged to the hospital. The nurse would hold them up to the window. I thought of them more as my husband's children. And then when I did bring them home, I felt like I was taking care of somebody else's children, that they weren't mine. I couldn't, didn't feel this so-called immediate love, you are my children reaction that I had thought every woman feels.
Idealistically, you plan to, you know, you've got it all set up in your head. You want a nurse because it's a communication between you and the baby that's going to bring you closer together. And you find out that they bring the baby every 4 hours, and the baby woke up in 3 hours and was hungry, so they fed it. So they bring it to you, and it's full, and it's not hungry, and you hold it for an hour, and you snap it on the cheek, and you pull its mouth open, and it doesn't know you, it doesn't care, it doesn't relate to you, and you think, Jesus, could be anybody's baby.
It could be, but it's not. The baby is yours. You take it home, learn to care for it. You become, over a period of long years, something, someone people call mother. You've moved without changing your address to a new region. A place uncharted on the map of Minnesota, but intimately known by women all over the state. There's no neat way to study the terrain. It's more a matter of exploration. You will discover the hills and valleys, the sunny spots and the stormy cold nights of this place all on your own. You'll learn, oh yes you will, all about this region within walls.
Oh, hard is the fortune of all womankind. They're always controlled, they're always confined. Controlled by their parents until they are wives. Then slaves to their husbands the rest of their lives. Oh, hard is the fortune of all womankind. They're always controlled, they're always confined. Controlled by their parents until they are wives. Then slaves to their husbands the rest of their lives.
Before I got married, right after high school, I babysat for my mother, who had 5 children left at home, for a full week. And I was so busy all day long, cleaning, cooking, changing diapers, doing all the kinds of things that housewives have to do. And I remember sitting down and being scared and saying, my gosh, I'm so busy, I couldn't ask to be busier. But what have I done?
Mommy.
I've done nothing.
Mommy.
That really intrigues me. And it scared me. And I thought, I'm not going to do that when I get married. And I think at that point, maybe I could have thought more about how I could have avoided that. Because I find myself in that very situation right now where you're not lazy. Very few housewives are lazy as far as I can tell, or can even afford to be. But you just don't feel gratified at the end of the day. And I'm just happy that there are quite a few people who feel that they have to fight this kind of thing. They have to find something else to do with your time. Yeah, I remember that.
Patty Flaherty is 25, mother to 2 children. A typical day in her life goes something like this.
I try to get up early enough so that I have a half hour before the children wake up. Then I read the newspaper, have a cup of tea, do the crossword puzzle if I have time. The children get up and I feed them. And I do the breakfast dishes. I try to get my children interested in some kind of project if they're not already finding something on their own. Then I usually do something with the children in the morning, something that we can do together. And then I feed them lunch, try to do lunch dishes, put the children down for a nap, clean up the house, which would involve picking up all the rubble and garbage that has accumulated all morning and probably, you know, since the day before is afternoon. And then I start fixing supper, and my husband helps me with that. And I do the dishes. My husband generally takes the children while I'm doing the dishes. And then there should be some spare time in there somewhere, and I can't quite make out where it should be. Oftentimes we do something in the evening, not always, but oftentimes we do go somewhere down to the beach, or you know, down to the bridge.
As a family.
Yeah, oftentimes we do a small family thing, even if it is just going to the grocery store or some such thing. Then we come home and put our daughter to bed and generally wrangle with our son for a couple of hours, and then he's in bed. And during the course of that evening, either my husband or I or both of us are able to read. That's generally our pastime in the evening. Or I will be knitting or sewing. And that's it. You know, and by the time the kids go to bed, you feel like you haven't had any time at all to spend with your husband. You're generally quite tired by that time, or I'm quite tired by that time, and you almost feel like you should stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning to have some enjoyment together.
Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's gonna buy you a mockingbird. And if that mockingbird don't say Mama's gonna buy you a diamond ring.
The thing that I enjoy most is if I can get the kids interested in something new and something that really intrigues them, you know, create a project of my own for them or help them create a project of their own. That is what I enjoy. In terms of housework, I enjoy having a reasonable house and I enjoy having a, you know, smooth running place, but I don't really enjoy doing it. Scrubbing floors is no way fun, you know. And dishes are just insidious because every time you do them, they're right back again. And I don't, you know, how could anybody enjoy doing the dishes? I think the problem is that none of it seems particularly useful to me. Granted, all these things have to be done in order to live day to day, but nothing seems very important.
Well, you know, it's occurred to me, too, that one of the things that you have to deal with when you have children is that children require a lot of attention. If you want to raise them right, you want to give them a lot of attention, and you want to find interesting projects for them so they can learn and grow and develop and all of those things. But when you're home, whether or not, you know, there's somebody standing over your, you know, with a club or something, you feel obligated to get those dishes done and to get that floor scrubbed, and you have a conflict then because you have children who are interrupting you when you're doing that work that is for some reason important, and you can't give them the attention that they require, and yet you have to get these other things done, and so you can't do either very well. And you end up shoving your children away and getting angry with them, or they get very upset, and you know, you're really in a bind. Mm-hmm. You don't really know which way to go. Do you leave the house and let it go to hell?
I rather envy a lot of the people from our parents' generation who never questioned it and always felt that keeping a house and doing all the work that was involved with that was a labor of love.
One day I was walking, I heard a complaining. I saw an old woman, the picture of gloom. She gazed at the mud on her doorstep, 'twas raining. And this is her song as she wielded her broom. Oh, life is a toil and love is a trouble. Beauty will fade and riches will flee. Pleasures will they dwindle and prices they double. And nothing is as I would wish it to be.
Jane Grey Swisshelm edited the St. Cloud Visitor, later the St. Cloud Democrat, in the 1860s. Early in her marriage, she discovered that she possessed a talent for painting and began to struggle with the tension created by the need for self-expression and the requirements of her household. From her autobiography, Half a Century, published in 1880. What graceful lines and gorgeous colors floated around me. I forgot God and did not know it, forgot philosophy and did not care to remember it. But alas, I forgot to get Bard's dinner, and although I forgot to be hungry, I had no reason to suppose that he did. He would willingly have gone hungry rather than give anyone trouble, but I had neglected a duty. Not only once did I do this, but again and again, the fire went out or the bread ran over in the pans while I painted and dreamed. My conscience began to trouble me. Housekeeping was a woman's sphere, although I had never then learned the words, for no woman had gotten out of it to be hounded back. But I knew my place and scorned to leave it. I tried to think I could paint without neglect of duty. It did not occur to me that painting was a duty for a married woman. Had the passion seized me before marriage, no other love could have come between me and my art. But I felt that it was too late. My life was already devoted to another object, housekeeping. It was a hard struggle. I tried to compromise, but experience soon deprived me of that hope. For to paint was to be oblivious of all other things. In my doubt, I met one of those newspaper paragraphs with which men are wont to pelt women into subjection. A man does not marry an artist, but a housekeeper. This fitted my case, and my doom was sealed. I pushed away my brushes, resolutely crucified my divine gift, and while it hung writhing on the cross, spent my best years and powers cooking cabbage.
This too much of worriment goes to a bonnet. There's too much of ironing goes into a shirt. There's nothing that pays for the time you waste on it. There's nothing that lasts us but trouble and dirt. It's sweeping at 6 and it's dusting at 7. It's breakfast at 8 and it's dishes at 9. It's potting and padding from 10 to 11. We scarce get a break till we plan how to dine. Oh, life is a toil and love is a trouble. Beauty will fade and riches will flee. Pleasures, they dwindle and prices, they double. And nothing is as I would wish it to be. Last night in my dreams I was stationed forever on a far little rock in the midst of the sea. My one chance of life was a ceaseless endeavor to sweep off the waves as they swept over me. Alas, 'twas no dream, ahead I behold it. I see I am helpless, my fate to avert. She laid down her broom and her apron she folded. She lay down and died and was buried in dirt. Oh, life is a toil and love is a trouble. Beauty will fade and riches will flee. Pleasures, they dwindle and prices, they double. And nothing is as I would wish it to be.
I have felt totally frustrated creatively in as far as painting and my crafts, reading. You know, any of the things that go into my life, I've had to file away in my mind for other days. And you reach a certain point where you are just totally absorbed by children, and I'm just not crazy about children from this. Before I had Jeremy, I considered myself one of those people that's just kind of, you know, oh, she gets along with children so well. But now, you know, I've had my fill. I wouldn't go out of my way to, you know, to volunteer taking care of children other than the ones that I take care of as a living. You know, it's no more a big myth to me. It has its real sides now. It's got other dimensions.
Carol Erickson, at 22, has an infant son but no husband. For 16 months, her life has been totally child-centered. I knew her in her pregnancy, soft-eyed, complacent, biologically and psychologically preparing to enter this other region. Today, she reflects on its unpredictable dimensions.
When he was an infant, I didn't have days. It was just from minute to minute, and he was a colicky child. I mean, there were times where he would just go 24 hours. And because I did not want to, you know, accept a lot of overpowering help from my parents, who I was living with at the time, I was the one that got up and always took care of him. And there were times when I was sure I was losing my mind, just absolutely positive that I was not going to live another day, that I was just so physically and mentally exhausted. And I could not see myself getting out of it at all. I really felt like I was going down for the third time. But by the time that he was 4 months old and his, you know, nervous system was straighter, and I could start somewhat getting out. And then I moved out when I, let's see, was 6 months old. Then things changed quite a bit until I'm at the point today where, because I have many more outside contacts and because I am working, and the woman that I work for provides transportation for me, I can think more in concepts of what's going to happen to me in the next couple of years. Oops. And it's no longer, you know, like just from like an hour to hour thing, but my days are much more pleasant to me. You know, we get up quite early and we spend a lot of time outside. He spends time with his friends, and I'm able, even when he's around now, to concentrate on things, which I guess is really hard to realize that having a child around, you can't even, you know, you can't sit down and start writing your income tax out, you know, or doing this or that, because they just totally want your attention. And if they don't have yours and there's no one else's in the house that they can have, you're really stuck. So you start doing things like I do. You know, I start doing my sewing and my important things, like at 10 o'clock at night, after all things are all settled down, and sometimes I'll be up until 4. See, you know, I had to make the choice, well, is it sleep or is it accomplishing something that has to be done, or something that gives me some type of recreation? Sometimes there are more important things to me than just having sleep.
Young girls, they dance and they flirt and flit.
I don't know if I ever want to become tightly involved with one man. It's a concept I've grown up with all my life, and I just am really shying away from it now, because there are too many things that I want to do, and I don't want anyone to encompass me in his life or his dreams. Sometimes I think, gee, you know, if I'd never had Jeremy at the particular time that I had him, I could have gone on living in a lot of fantasy worlds. And I am really thankful to him that way, that he just, I mean, it was a hard way to do it, but I'm still really young. And I think, you know, by the time that he's old enough to be almost on his own, I'm only going to be 35, 36 years old. You know, and I'm kind of happy about it when I think of it that way. Because I just see myself, I envision my dreams for myself are so much broader than they ever were before. Just because I went through such a period where there was nothing else but this kid. That now there are just no, I have just no limits for myself now. I really feel like, goddamn, I can accomplish anything I want to if I just get it together. If other people just let me get it together, especially if men just let me get it together. So, in that way, you know, even when I'm playing with him, I'll think of, well, Jeremy, you know, well, you really did a lot of good things for your old ma.
City's poet Burla Williams asks, "Will you miss me?" Some days, I manage not to be a poet. In fact, some days manage me so far from poetry, I think I've reached a static state. Therefore, I know it can be done. You will come home happily to find me stirring first course soup, smell yeasty pungence of homemade bread. My hair will be smooth, my face bright like a blank sheet of paper, waiting for your kiss, your day's experience to be written upon it. The house will blind you with its shine. You'll find no scraps of recorded thoughts, no stones petaled or curled leaves that hold the images of a dozen poems. And even if a day may come when the sun casts strange blue-edged shadows on the snow, the wind snags a new note or carries back some old, old sound I had forgot, I will turn my eyes and ears away. Be chauffeur, housemaid, nursemaid, mistress, be your good wife. I will not clutter your life with sharp-pronged, faceted fragments of whoever I might have been. I will pour my love into the lives of our children and ignore the enchanted, unclaimed child tapping forever at my window. Ignore slant rays, stare at the sun until I'm blind to the difference of days, of selves. Be your simple woman, your mirror, my back held hard against the poem. Pretend away the blue-rimmed shadows.
A lot of people think that because I was thrown into this, you know, you've got 9 kids, you know, egads, wouldn't you do something else? But I really wouldn't do one thing different, not one. I can honestly say that I am very, I'm happy. We don't have everything that possibly our next-door neighbor has materially, but I feel that spiritually and emotionally, that as far as my life is concerned, I'm very content with it. I really wouldn't change places with anybody right now.
Marilyn Privette is 35, the mother of 9 children. It's safe to say that by now she knows the territory pretty well, and she says that she finds satisfaction and growth within its very real geographical limits. Home, school, church, neighborhood, these are the physical boundaries she operates within. Still, her life has a kind of flexibility. You can chalk it up to experience if you like, but Marilyn has some other thoughts on the matter.
We joined CFM, which is Christian Family Movement. And by Christian family, we don't mean that you have, you know, a million kids. That isn't the Christian family, is the church. And I think that one thing that they stress so emphatically is communication between partners. And then everything else comes relatively easy. And I think we joined in 66. And as far as being what I felt, a total person, I think it came more at that time than it had before. I mean, I realized more who I was at that time, and that I still was a person even wrapped up with all these people. Like, I'm not taking complete credit for all this, because Tom is the way that he is with the kids, and he doesn't feel that it's not his job. And I think a lot of men contribute to their wives' insanity, if you want to say that you know, they say, you know, dishes, you're crazy, that's not my job. You know, whoever said that it was a woman's job to do dishes or a man's job to rake the lawn? We don't feel that each of us has a particular place in this house. We're here and we're a family, and we're a man and we're a woman, and whatever we feel like doing at that time, not that I feel like doing dishes or he feels like doing dishes, but if they're there, that's what we do. And we've always done this since the time we've been married, you know, that we haven't had a certain job or, you know, place in the house. We're just together.
Look in through my windows. See the old blue sofa, the round table with the fringed cloth, the stately secretary, the fireplace. Count the spaces at the dining table. Watch the candles, flames flickering, standing splendid in holders of silver. Where once you might have looked, the sofa bulged with springs unsprung. The draperies, plastic, $198 on special. Television sound filled every corner of every room. Then there, dreaming of silver candle holders, decisions were decided. Life was committed to the shining vision. And now? Now can I say the silver's tarnished, the candle's burned down too far? Can I toss away the polishing cloth, leaving the dust behind, and walk out into the gleaming night? Look in through my windows. Tell me, you see me? Doll in a Carriage by Molly Ernst from her book of poems, Prima Gravida, published by Earth Art Publishing, Woodbridge, Connecticut. Excerpt from Half a Century, the autobiography of Jane Grey Swisshelm, published by Janssen McClurg & Company, Chicago, 1880. Will You Miss Me by Burla Williams, published in the Hamlin University Bulletin, September 1972.
The third segment of A Sense of Place is continued on side two.
Nursery rhymes from the Golden Records album, 101 Golden Nursery Songs. And special thanks to Kay Lukanen for performing three selections from her repertoire of feminist folk songs. A Sense of Place was written and produced by Claudia Daly for Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. Engineering by David Felland.
Because I know how it
This young snort from the agricultural school came out there to North Dakota to look over my land and my stock. He said he was going to appraise everything on my farm for the government. He said he was going to make a report on everything there and help me pull out of the red. Well, he looked over everything, wrote it all down on the record neat as a pin, stuck his nose into everything there. He thought he just about had everything when he saw an animal looking around the house. We keep the old goat because we had him so long. What's he, the young squirt asked, and what's he for? I said, you're the expert here. You tell me. I ain't supposed to tell you. Well, he said, I don't know what it is. I'll just have to wire back and find out what it is so I can put it down on my report. All right, I says, laughing. You do that. So he wired clean to Washington, to Secretary Wallace, I guess, and he said, there's an object here, and I don't know what it is. It's long and lean with a bald head, chin whiskers, empty, lean stomach, a long, sad face, and sad, cadaverous eyes. What is it? And Wallace wired back. You wet-behind-the-ears, mewling baby jackass? That's the farmer! We are at the crossroads of history. We don't want to be railroaded through. We don't want to fold up like a jackknife. There are things solemn and dear to us. This is a grave situation, and we must stand together. Where are we to stand upon the future? The farmers are on the march.
For a lot of reasons, we're taking people from the land and putting them in the wrong place. We have more arable, livable land in the United States than any country in the world. And instead of encouraging our people in the cities to move there and to become a part of that, We're doing it the other way around. We're taking people from the farms and moving them into the cities. And if you travel the roads in any of our farming states, you see empty farmhouses, those that are still standing. Miles and miles of them, and they're concentrated in just one farmer farming it all.
They appointed me to their Agriculture Relations Board this spring, and it's part of a few other groups that they have started in this district. Another group I know I have started was where the teachers have to get involved in studying minority groups. I forget the name of it, but it's called a cultural group, by the way. And I didn't know this at the time either until the last meeting, where one of the representatives came to our meeting and asked for references to study agriculture, because we seem to be the minority in this country already.
They work hard day in and day out, and they satisfy themselves, they tend to satisfy themselves in large part with what they consider realistic appraisals of what's available to them. That doesn't mean that they should have what they have or they deserve what they have. It simply means that if you're living in a relative state of deprivation, if you always are looking, let's say, at the highest levels of rewards in the society, whether it's through TV commercials or someplace else, it's going to be a terribly frustrating experience. One has to make the adjustment in a society where there are as many inequities as there are in our society.
I knew out here we could live on very little. We've had extremely thin years. I mean, poverty years, years with a couple thousand dollars income. But I raise all my own food organically here. We supply ourselves totally in food. Plus we sell. I sell food to organic stores and restaurants in the city. And to the Guthrie, that's my biggest customer.
I don't think most people realize how hard it really is, and I don't think most people would really enjoy it. I don't think a lot of people actually realize that this could potentially be farming country. It's traditionally been logging country and mining country, and that's the way it's always been looked at. But actually, if a person is willing to work and take a risk, it's certainly you're not going to have a bumper crop of tomatoes or anything, but there are crops that can be raised up here. In fact, a lot of people, they look at you like you're crazy when you tell them you're trying to farm. They just tell you, well, you won't be able to make it.
A Sense of Place, a documentary series which looks at regions and regionalism in the state of Minnesota. Produced by Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. This program is called, How You Gonna Keep 'Em Down on the Farm? From the days when 160 acres of fertile prairie land in western Minnesota felt like a kingdom to Scandinavian immigrants, through grasshopper plagues, droughts, and the depression of the 1930s, to today's immense agribusiness enterprises and their opposite phenomenon, tiny organic operations, the idea of the farm has held claim to the imagination of Minnesotans. Oh, farm kids come to town to be where the action was, could listen with wry amusement to city types who talked of getting a little piece of land somewhere, being my own boss. But they knew what working with the land was all about. And if all else failed, that knowledge in their bones was not exactly like money in the bank, but a means to survival, anyway.
My father was a farmer, and his father was a farmer, and my mother's side, they were all farmers too, so it's been in the farm end of it. I think that unless it's going to change, I mean, farmers always have been farmers, and their sons have always been farmers, and there have been very few people that born in the city come to the farm and started farming.
Ralph Blenker has been farming his 157 acres of Stearns County for a dozen years. He has a dairy herd and crops that help sustain it. And though he's not a rich man, he's doing nicely. Blenker and his wife, Corrine, are rearing 8 children in a spacious new home on their traditional family farm.
I guess it was just my blood. Once you're in the business, you just grow with it. And I just love to see things grow. I love to see put the seed in the ground and see it come up and harvest it. And livestock, a new baby's born, let's see a cow gives a calf. I love to see it come up and grow. It's a daily routine. Comparing it to a factory which I just go in and did one job every day and the rest of my life, I don't accomplish anything. And by working with something that grows, I'm satisfied. I've got more of a risk in this business, and I play with nature, but this is part of everybody's farming business. If I had to do all the work alone in this farm, I don't think I'd be this efficient, because there's too many things to touch and turn over and do. My brother lives next door, and we own machinery in partnership, and we run it back and forth. But there's nothing that's specific that's for him or for me. We do it all.
Corrine Blenker also performs a daily round of chores, and the Blenker youngsters all learn how to be good farmers from the time they're 3 years old.
Like, there's a lot of things to do on a farm, you know, work, feeding the cows, feeding the calves. When you first you milk the cows, and then you put some milk in a calf pail, and then you should feed the calves. You know, if they're small, then you just hold up so they drink out of it. When they get bigger, like heifers, they eat hay and feed and all that.
Drive tractors, wipe the dishes and sometimes wash, see mangers. Sometimes carry the hay out. You get strong,
yeah.
Healthy.
Mitty Matty had a hen, she laid eggs for gentlemen, sometimes nine and sometimes ten, Mitty Matty's fine fat hen. Mitty Matty had a hen, she laid eggs for gentlemen, sometimes nine and sometimes ten, Mitty Matty's fine fat hen.
Oh, you've got to be a half a veterinarian. And half a mechanic, and half an accountant, and a strong back and weak mind. Sometimes I enjoy it when it rains, and I can just sit down and think a while. But if it rains, for example, 1972, if it rains too much, then, well, you don't want to say the bad things about it because it can turn dry on us. But in your mind, you just think a little different.
I was a small farmer. Fred Andrew, president of the Superior Farming Company of California and Arizona, told reporters in the March 1973 issue of Saturday Review Society. And there's no way you can do it today. You need technology and you need efficiency. And there's no way the individual farmer can do that.
He's a big man, he's a small man, he's a laughing, working, tall man. He comes in all assorted shapes and sizes, happy, sad, wide and lean. He's a farmer. He's tomorrow's breakfast with a grin on his face. He's the nation's breadbasket with a cocked left eyebrow. He wakes at dawn to feed the world. He carries nations on his big shoulders. He holds the earth in his hands and lives by the sun and the rain. He's America riding a tractor, democracy wearing a straw hat. He's freedom holding a hoe. He's the future of the world in a pair of blue overalls.
That whole enterprise.
University of Minnesota sociologist Dr. George Donahue.
Farming, where there's diversified farming, a whole series of products to commercial, specialized farming. You might say that about 60% of the farmers in the countryside are marginal in the sense that they're not really essential to the production of food and fiber in this country as a whole. Now, I know that sounds rather crass, and if I were a farmer and somebody said that, I would resent that statement. But when you look at the picture, you find that 80% of the product of food and fiber in this country happen to be produced by about 20% of the farmers. That means that the remainder produce very little. And you could say that even those 20% who produce the 80% are not practicing the highest levels of efficiency with regard to inputs, technological inputs and other inputs, labor inputs and so forth.
Since the dawn of time, he's wrestled the land and squeezed life from the angry soil. Armies march on his muscles. Cities eat on his labors. He fills the marketplace and makes the wheels of commerce whirl. He's a farmer. Politicians promise him things. Bankers respect him. Middlemen live off him. He's day laborer and capitalist, handyman and boss, toolmaker, mechanic, veterinarian, salesman, purchasing agent, production manager, weather forecaster, and good neighbor.
Given the organization of the family farm, and having the farm life more or less coterminous with the life of the farmer himself, and not thinking sort of in an indefinite timeline the way the corporation does, and then thinking of hiring labor and so forth to work on the farm, as a corporation does, you would think to limit the enterprise to the availability of family labor and to the activities of the farm owner. So you have a completely different frame of reference as well as timeline that you happen to be working with in the family farm. See, that timeline is changing, and those efficient farms, even though they remain family farms, many of them have a timeline that exists beyond the life of the family. In the sense they're beginning to think of extending the farm indefinitely, and when they make capital investments and land investments, some of their family may take it on, or they may sell at a certain point to another family, so that the lifespan of the farm, that is, what build up and a decline in the farm, is not the same as the build up in a person's life and the decline, as was true of the old family farm.
He likes the smell of alfalfa fields, and the look of dawn coming over a mountain, and the sound of cattle in a meadow, and the jaunty jig of a hoedown fiddle. He likes the music of small streams and the look of trees climbing a hill. He likes the breath of air filtered through growing fields and the echo of a sharp axe cutting into a tree trunk. He likes the look of corn shucks at autumn time and the smile of a harvest moon. He's a farmer.
There's still a lot of, quote, family farms, but these are the marginal farmers. Farming, let's say, of the way it was in the past in terms of the value system of the so-called family farm is probably best represented by part-time farmers today. Most of whom, well, let's say a third or better of the farms in the United States are part-time farmers. They produce about 2% of the marketable farm products. They're out there because they're the values that they associate with that type of activity. And that's the old notion of family farming, you see. It was a way of life, not a business enterprise. It had certain values beyond profit making in terms of the values that it might have for one's aesthetic appreciation of his environment or the interrelationship between him and his wife, the so-called socioeconomic unit of the family and its operation, the togetherness values or whatever else one might associate traditionally with farming.
He's the meat and potatoes of a nation. He's the ham and eggs on the menu at a restaurant. He's Halloween pumpkins and cold watermelons at a 4th of July picnic. He's the turkey and yams at a Thanksgiving Day dinner table. He's a farmer. Tan and lean, he's always the first of the pioneers. He breaks frontiers and clears the earth and tames the land for the city men to come. He's a strong man and a gentle man, strong enough to hold a plowing line against the hard earth and gentle enough to caress a newborn calf with loving hands. His tall, strong sons fight the nation's wars, and his bustling wife brings gentleness and peace to the raw plains and the wild valleys.
The fact remains that there are still millions upon millions of people who are seeking to fulfill their life's desires and experiences in open country and in small communities throughout the country. And I think that's what we should do, is consider equity among different types of social structures for citizens as a whole. And in order to do that, we're going to have to begin to think of to what degree can we permit people to live in areas that might have to be subsidized, not only economically, but socially, you know, in terms of some type of social policy regarding social services, which might cost us dollars. But in the final analysis, we'd say this is a desirable balance of types of social organization and types of life experience that Americans may choose.
He's a farmer, always a pawn of the times. He's a gambler. He throws his seed like dice on a giant gambling table of land. He bets his muscles and his know-how on the heat of the sun and the turn of a rain cloud. Sometimes he wins, sometimes he loses. The gods make him sweat for his winnings. He builds the schools and hews the logs for the churches. He takes wild land and tames it into peaceful acres. And he makes the smoke rise from friendly chimneys dotted across the plains. His hands toll the church bells on country Sundays. He lives by the code of the land and never refuses a helping hand to a friend or a stranger. He's America's best customer. He's the world's most constant hope. He's the most useful man in America. He's a farmer.
Stephen Pitch, writing in the North Country Anvil number 5. Why did my parents like farming so much? Why did they never complain? Why did they never want to sell the farm and seek a different way of life? How could they be unaware of what was happening around them? How could they actually choose to live on a farm when so many others were selling their farms, finding comfortable jobs, and leading the good life? Failing to find the answers to these questions by the time I finished high school, I was resolved to find the good life, which my parents, for some reason, had ignored. Well, I graduated from college, earned a master's degree, got married, and found a job. Tomorrow I will have to get up at 6 a.m. and start my hour drive to work over an overcrowded, congested freeway. I'll have to work in a windowless office, breathing air polluted by cigar and cigarette smoke. I'll fight my way through traffic to the grocery store to buy a quart of milk. I'll have to make a TV dinner because my wife will still be on the freeway trying to get home from her job. I'll take my son to the zoo to see the animals. I'll see about getting the air conditioner fixed. I'll send a check to the health spa. I'll apologize to my wife for complaining constantly about my job, my boss, the traffic, the noise, and a million other things. I am 25 years old today. I know now why Mom and Dad never sought the good life. They had it all the time.
A farmer boy, for me. If ever I marry all in my life, it's a farmer boy for me. When my Johnny sings behind the plow, it's music sweet to me. And if ever I marry all in my life, it's a farmer's wife I'll be. I would not marry a railroader that drives the engine train. I'd rather marry a farmer boy that loves the wind and rain. When my Johnny sings behind the plow, it's music sweet to me. And if ever I marry all in my life, it's a farmer's wife I'll be. I would not marry a doctor man, he's full of pains and pills. I'd rather marry a farmer boy with corn upon the hills. When my Johnny sings behind the plow, it's music sweet to me. And if ever I marry all in my life, it's a farmer's wife I'll be. I would not marry a lawyer man, he tells too many lies. I'd rather work with my farmer boy beneath the open skies. When my Johnny sings behind the plow, it's music sweet to me. And if ever I marry all in my life, it's a farmer's life I'll be.
Minnesota poet Lewis Jenkins. As she smells the clean sheets, the farmer's wife remembers the 1930s. Wind whips the clothes on the line, blows her dress tight against her heavy legs. The farmer, in his dirty overalls, searches through years of broken machinery behind the barn, searches through tall sunflowers, through the nests of rabbits and mice, with a wrench in his hand, looking for exactly the right part, or one that might do. 7 skinny cows lie in the mud where the tank overflows. Throughout the hot afternoon, the windmill continues to pump long drafts of cool water.
Just like a mob coming in, really, you don't believe it. You can't see anything but this wave of people coming down the aisles, you know. Really, I don't know how to explain it. It's a real experience there. The first time you've been at the market on a Saturday, for instance, which is your busiest day, it's just unbelievable. You know, the doors are closed and everybody's inside the market, kind of, all the farmers are just kind of waiting and tensed up and standing by the booth, and you hear this noise outside of the market. I don't know what else you can call it. It's just human noise. And then the next thing you know, the doors open and pow, you just flooded, and there's people standing 6 or 7 deep in the lines. There's probably 10 lines across the front of each booth, you know. It's just like a big sale at one of your supermarkets or something, you know. It's just fantastic. But it's fun because you're dealing right with the people, you know, and you can talk to them a little bit, and everybody's got kind of a funny word or a kind word to say. You know, you don't see too many grouchy people coming down the farmer's market to buy vegetables. And that's just a good group of people that come in for fresh produce, and they realize they're getting it, and it's, you know, just big happy family trading is what it is, you know.
Bob and Chris Walton are performing the somewhat remarkable feat of growing in the rocky soil and capricious climate of northeastern Minnesota just outside Duluth. Some 17 acres of vegetable crops for sale through the farmer's market and out of the home on their tenant farm. In their mid-20s, and rather more practical than philosophical, the Waltons had no farm experience in their backgrounds. They learned how to do it through college courses, county agents, advice from other farmers, and sometimes difficult experience.
We had a very bad year last year, as did everybody all over the country, all over the world. In fact, it was a bad year for farming. I wouldn't go into farming if I didn't feel that you could make not only your living and support your family in a relative amount of comfort. Certainly you're not going to be driving Cadillacs, but you can have a car and have most of the comforts that anybody else can have, and you can have a decent savings plan, and you can look forward to retiring and supporting yourself comfortably. I speak of subsistence farming as being just that, being able to support yourself and live comfortably for the duration of your life. You're not going to be hiring 10 or 20 other families and supporting them. You're just going to be subsisting yourself. You have to look at it from the family standpoint. My wife is, as you know, an artist. So she, this is advantageous for her. She has the country living, and she can paint out here. She has the quiet and the serenity that the country provides. And I enjoy wildlife, and I enjoy being able to raise my ducks and geese and chickens without somebody disturbing them constantly, and I enjoy being able to walk out in the field and have deer fairly close by. And it's sort of like when our nation was young, you know, and the pioneering families, you're certainly not a pioneer in the strict sense of the word, but you're a pioneer as far as yourself goes, your own values and your own ideals. You're still searching and you're still developing, and so are most of these other people that are going back to the land there, and you are helping one another just as the early settlers did. There really, especially in this area, there isn't too many places you can go to for advice. You don't want to sound like you're trying to be a hermit, but it is nice to get away from people and to look out and know that there's nobody back there, you know, just the land. It just gives you a feeling of self-assurance, I suppose. I don't know really how it can or how it does, but it does. It just makes you feel good to sit there and know that you're by yourself, just you and the land.
From Rain Gatherer, a book of poems by Franklin Brainerd, recently published by the Minnesota Writers Publishing House. I put in cedar posts instead of pitch, and was glad with the more temporary thing. Each has its grace and strength, but I knew that cedar would see me through. I felt at times as if there were something pompous about a longer impermanence. I have seen too many monuments of death whose carvings grow illegible. In rural graveyards, the single hand, its index finger up, stands reminding and rum about the sign gone home. Well, manure is a temporary thing, and so are the songs of those who sing walking behind the spreader. And I take for better the singing of the folk who walk and know their walk. And if my cedar posts become the soil that holds them, and the rusted wires fail, I know another will build his fence on the same old heaving ground, sensing that even where my old posts stand, they will no longer do.
I'm the biggest organic farming playwright in the country. I'm a tenant farmer. I'm a poor tenant farmer up here. And that isn't any conceit. That's our exaggeration. We came out here 5 years ago after I left the Guthrie Theater. For a variety of reasons. I've got a family that I wanted to get out. But that wasn't the real reason. I think I was sick of the cities. I mean, that's an escapist attitude. I ran away from the cities. I ran back to a kind of world that if I didn't know exactly from living in Nebraska on a farm, I knew what it was going to be like. this particular community just was a lucky guess.
Minnesota playwright Fred Gaines, now farming and writing near the town of Somerset, Wisconsin.
Farming in the north, and they call this the upper Midwest, it's the north, as far as I'm concerned. We get 90 days, if we're lucky, of growable weather. I'm really only invited about 5 months a year. With my animals, I've got 30-some head of cattle out there. I'm involved in a lesser capacity all year round, but that doesn't—that involves me for an hour and a half morning chores in a night. So really, I can work 4 or 5 months, and then I'm free the rest of the year. And I really enjoy the labor of farming and gardening. Yeah, it really does help my head work. It helps my head work in the sense that, I hope farmers aren't listening, it's idiot labor. I don't need to involve my head very much, because most of it is very simple work. Now, I'm not talking about the decisions that have to be made. I'm talking about the actual labor, throwing hay and cleaning manure and plowing, that kind of thing. And when I'm doing that, your head really races ahead. You're not aware of it. You know, it's like a cushion period. It's like an empty period that things just sort of fill in. It does. It helps me a tremendous amount. Plus, I've found that I'm writing more and more about the people I grew up with, which were rural people, and people I'm living with now. I mean, I think some of my best writing is about people who are non-city people, or village people, or farm people. I think you learn a different kind of respect for life. And I don't mean any exalted, lyrical kind of that soul thing. I'm not into that at all. It's a much more kind of direct. You see yourself. You see people reflected in animals, rather than seeing, rather than putting any kind of, you know, anthropomorphic soul or something in a cow. A cow is a cow, but it has. It's exhilarating to watch a cow, to try to nurse back a sick cow or something. You get involved. You're suddenly aware of how vulnerable you are yourself. You invest so much of yourself in animals. You can't be a writer, really, until you have hurt yourself in some kind of way. I don't mean a psychic way at all, but until you realize how much you care about things.
Part 4 of A Sense of Place is continued on cassette number 3.